Luke 8:22-8:39, the 37th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 12, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I want to look at the two next sections of the Gospel of Luke. This will start in chapter 8, verse 22. And we're going to take it through verse 39, but there's two separate events here. I don't have a lot to say about the first one. Actually, I don't have a lot to say about either of them, so I think we can do both of them. Reading off of my translation here. Now, on one of those days, he got into a boat as well as his disciples, and he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." So they launched out, and as they were sailing along, he fell asleep. Then a fierce gale of wind descended on the lake, and they began to get swamped and in danger. They came to Jesus and woke him up, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he got up and enjoined the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" They were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Then they sailed to the region of the Gergesenes, which is the shore opposite to Galilee. And when he came out onto the land, a man plagued by demons who was from the town encountered him. Now for a long time he had not worn his garment, and he was not living in a house but among the tombs. Recognizing Jesus, he shrieked and fell down before him, and in a loud voice said, "What is your concern with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to depart from the man. Now it had seized him many times. Indeed, he kept being bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard. Yet breaking his bonds, he would repeatedly be driven by these demons into the desert. And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And it said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they kept imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. Now there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain, so the demons implored him to permit them to go away, to go among the swine, and he gave them permission. And leaving the man, the demons went over to the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. The people went out to see, and they came up to Jesus. They found the man from whom the demons had departed sitting at the foot of at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. Now the people became frightened, even as the ones who saw how the man plagued by demons had been made well reported it to him. And all the people of the country of the Gergesenes and the surrounding district asked him to depart from them, for they were gripped with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. But the man from whom the demons had departed kept begging him that he might go with him. But he sent him away, saying, "Return to your house and describe what great things God has done for you." So he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. Okay, the first account, very, very simple account. Jesus and the disciples at this point are on the west side of this, what's called the Sea of Galilee, a lake that's about 8 miles at the north, 8 miles wide, 5 miles wide at the south, about 13 miles long, fairly large lake. And they're on the northwest shore probably at this time, as best I can locate them. And Jesus says, "Let's go to the other side of the lake." And the question is exactly, what is the other side of the lake from where he is? I'm going to argue, and I'll get into this later, but I'm going to argue that he's headed toward a point about midpoint along the eastern shore of the lake. There's textual variants that make it difficult to know exactly where the event takes place. But for some reason, he says, "Let's go to the other side of the lake." He gets in a boat, and he and the disciples travel to the other side of the lake. Mark argues that there are other boats with them. What's not clear is whether the disciples themselves break up into groups and are in separate boats, or whether the 12 are together with Jesus in one boat, If so, that would have been a full boat, because the boats that were used on the Sea of Galilee usually only carried 10 to 12 people. So I think it's likely that the 12 broke up into groups and took other disciples with them. We don't have any indication that it's only the 12 that are going. It just says his disciples. And we know in recent days that the women that he mentions a little earlier in the chapter are among these disciples, and there are a number of other disciples. So probably it's a little flotilla of boats that go across the lake. And remember, several of Jesus' immediate disciples, the 12 are fishermen, so they're well prepared to pilot a boat across the lake. The Sea of Galilee is notorious for sudden violent storms. The Sea of Galilee is in a rift in the land that begins at the northern end of the Sea of Galilee and runs all the way past the Dead Sea, which is the lowest point of the rift, and then gradually goes back up to sea level down the Arabah to the Gulf. So at this point, at the Sea of Galilee, it's about 700 feet below sea level, and on either side there are very, very high, we might call them hills, but mountains that rise up to a couple thousand feet on either side of the lake. So there's this tremendous drop down into the basin, and the cool air off the ocean would often come in over the mountains and collide with the warm air sitting over the lake and create violent thunderstorms. So it was pretty notorious for the danger that fishermen could be in because of these sudden storms. That's what happened in this occasion. Is they're on their way to the other side of the lake, and a sudden storm hits them, and it's so violent that it begins to swamp their boats, and it looks like they're in grave danger. In 24, they came to Jesus and woke him up, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." Now the question is, why are they approaching Jesus at this point? Couple of options. It could be that they are asking him to save them, and they expect him to save them. That's a possibility. The other possibility is they want him to know he's going to die before he dies, and that they're seeking to warn him. They don't want him to sleep through his own death. It's really kind of difficult to know. I think our first impulse, thinking of Jesus in the way that we do, is that we expect that they're asking him to save them, because that is what he goes on to do, and so we're anticipating that, sure, they know that Jesus can do wonderful things, and that's what he's going to do, on the one hand. On the other hand, the account goes on to say they marveled that he had the kind of authority that he had. I don't think they had a clue that Jesus had that kind of power. I don't think they expected Jesus to save them. I think they are just in danger and are reaching out to Jesus to say, "Jesus, we're in danger." I mean, I think that would be my impulse. If somebody was asleep and oblivious to the danger that they were in, you would want to warn them of the danger they were in. Not that he could do anything about it, but just he's in danger and you need to warn him. And I'm inclined to think that that's their motive for approaching Jesus. But instead of... to their surprise, Jesus just got up and said, "Be still. Shut up. Stop blowing. Stop making so much noise. I was sleeping." And a calm, this incredible calm stops. Well, the disciples recognized that this was supernatural. Storms don't just stop. Like they stopped here. The danger doesn't just go away with the suddenness with which it went away. I'll come back to 24 in a second. But so it says in the end of the section, they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? Now on the surface, it may seem odd to be surprised that a person who's raised people from the dead and has healed people, healed all kinds of people of all kinds of ailments of various kinds, blindness, leprosy, paralysis, and everything else. Why would you be surprised that he has the power over the wind and the waves? On the one hand. On the other hand, it really is startling when you stop to think of it. It's one thing to think that you can have the power over the physiology of another human being. But that's localized and specific, and a specific kind of knowledge and a specific kind of skill that would be demonstrated there. It would be easy to think of Jesus as just having a kind of talent, like some X-Man. Oh, okay, he's a healer. This guy's a healer. He has some kind of magical power that allows him to heal human bodies. But it's another thing to think that this man is a man who has power to command the whole of nature. Anything and everything is in nature. And it ends up expanding your conception of who this man is. And I think that's what's happening here. They come to realize Jesus is not just some sort of talented X-Man. Jesus is the one with authority over all of creation. So they're fearful and amazed. They're shocked at this thing. The only other thing of note here is in verse 20, in the end of 24, when he got up and enjoined the wave and the surging wind and the surging waves, and they stopped and it became calm, and he said to them, "Where is your faith?" Now that puzzled me for years, because especially if you understand the reason for the disciples approaching him, if they approached him in order to have him do something to save them, well then I'd say, well, there's their faith. I mean, because they thought that maybe you could do something about this. Well, on the one hand, I don't think that they did. But furthermore, why would he be challenging them in this regard? What has he given them to give them any kind of evidence that God had given him the authority to still this particular storm? I mean, the disciples have recognized that there are people that Jesus has healed, and there are people that Jesus has walked away from and left in their sickness, left in their ailment, whatever it is, in order to go off in the wilderness to pray or whatever, to rest. Jesus did not heal everyone who wanted to be healed. Well, even if you believe that he could still a storm, on what basis would you think that he would do this one? On what basis would we know that he had the authority from God to still these waves and to stop these winds? It's one thing to know that one has the authority and the power for something. It's an entirely different thing to know that he's going to use that power in this particular way at this particular time. Who of us knows that? So can you blame the disciples for their ignorance, their lack of knowledge, their not knowing what is in store for them in this danger that they're in? They don't know that they're going to be saved. They don't know what Jesus is going to do. They don't know if he has the authority from God at this point in time to do this particular miracle. So why is Jesus chastising them? You know, why is he scolding them? I think that's what he's doing. Where is your faith? I mean, what sort of faith are they supposed to have? Well, the only answer I can give to that is that they are evidencing something that Jesus thinks that they shouldn't evidence at this point in time, and that is a fear for their well-being. They are afraid because they are afraid that they are going to die here. Now, let me be clear about this. Not that fear is a problem. I mean, any one of us would be afraid, and I think even if they had the faith that Jesus thinks they lack, they would still be afraid. But what Jesus is reading here is a kind of desperation. Something is about to happen to me that must not happen to me. This is not acceptable. I will not accept this fate. And it seems to me that Jesus is expecting at this point in their life that through his teaching and through his example and through his counsel and encouragement to them, by this time they ought to know that a human being rests in the hands of his creator. It's God who's the author of my being, who has the full prerogative to describe and to define the script of my life, the end of my life, the fate that I must experience. It's God's prerogative to decide that. Whatever God wills to be the course of my life, that is to be the course of my life. And faith, on the part of you and me, faith is an attitude toward that that says, if that's the course of my life that you want for me, then that is what's good for me. That's what's acceptable to me. God, I want what you want, as Jesus put it so memorably in the garden, not my will, but your will be done. That's the essence of that aspect, of that element of faith, is the ability to bow before the Creator and say, I don't want what I want. I want what you want. As I interpreted the first temptation that Jesus went through, Jesus' response to Satan in the first temptation. Remember, he was hungry and starving in the wilderness, and Satan came to him and said, turn these stones into bread. And his response to them was to quote Deuteronomy, which, as I translate it, was, man does not base his life on mere food, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, or by the word that proceeds from God. And as I understand what he meant by that is, what is my life? What defines my life? What gives meaning and purpose to my life? What gives substance to my existence? It's having God's will played out in my existence. That's what makes it meaningful. That's what makes it good. That's what makes it what it ought to be. And for me to have the attitude that doesn't reject that and rebel against that, but embraces that attitude and says, yes, I want my life to be what God has scripted it to be. I want my life to be what he wants it to be. That's faith. Saying to God, so be it. Whatever you have in store for me, so let it be. That's a crucial aspect of our lives that we have to grasp, it seems to me, because our lives are full of tragedy and grief and sorrow, not to mention inconvenience. And that there's just so much in my life that is objectionable and annoying and irritating. And we can either fight that, or we can take the attitude, God, it wouldn't be here if it weren't you putting it here. It's your will that this be my life. It's your will that this be my lot. It's your will that this be the condition that I'm in and the state that I'm in. And I can embrace that, or I can resist it. I can fight it, or I can accept it. Accepting it is part of faith, the faith of a disciple of Jesus. I think he calls it faith because it comes down to my belief, my acknowledgement, my understanding that I have an understanding that I have embraced, that I'm not the master of my existence. There is one bigger than me who's the master of my existence, and it's his prerogative to define my life as it should be, not my prerogative to define my life the way I want it to be. And it's believing that is a crucial part of believing the truth. And that's, I think, why he calls it faith here. Where is your faith? Years ago, when I taught on this passage, I remember noting that since we are in the church, are a group of believers, and it's an element of belief that we be able to say to God, so be it, to whatever happens in life, I think that makes us the so be it union. Now we go on to the next passage. Couple of things that I spent most of my time trying to sort out, what's going on here, because we have two different parallel passages and we have a ton of textual variations in this passage that makes it difficult to know what was the original text and what were the facts of the matter here. In both Luke and I think it's Matthew, no, in both Mark and Luke, we have Jesus confronting one individual who's plagued by a demon. In the Matthew account, we have two individuals who are plagued by a demon, and both of them come and confront Jesus. What do we do with that? We've seen this a number of times, but there are different details occasionally among the different Gospels, but they're almost always explainable, as I think this one is. They're almost always explainable because the Gospel writer is selecting the amount and degree and kind of detail that he wants to include in his account. Those of us who believe in the inerrancy of the Scriptures, we believe in the inerrancy of the Scriptures. We don't believe in the precision of the Scriptures. And there's an important distinction there. No, it doesn't make any sense to argue that I believe that everything that the Bible says is with explicit precision, and everything that happened has been told to me by every gospel writer. That's not true. I mean, it's clearly not true. Because their purpose, the gospel writer's purpose, was not to give me a completely exhaustive, detailed account of everything that occurred. Their purpose, as John puts it quite well, their purpose in writing the account is so that I might believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that in believing I might have life in his name. I mean, that's why they're telling us this stuff. They have a theological agenda. They have a evangelistic agenda, if you will. They want me to know enough to be able to decide for myself that Jesus is who he claimed to be so that I might believe. Well, you don't need exhaustive precision in order to accomplish that purpose, so they don't give us an exhaustive precision. But every now and then, given that these were eyewitnesses, certain facts are burned into their memory, burned into their memory of this event, and they include those details. But whereas the detail may be unimportant with respect to the purpose of the account or the meaning of the account, it's nonetheless a part of the eyewitness's memory, and he includes it. And I think that's the situation here. There was this minor player who had nothing to do with it, this second demon-possessed person who came down and confronted Jesus, but for whatever reason, he's not a prominent figure. Maybe if the relevant, it's hard to know who the relevant personality is, the human being or the demon, but if the human being is the relevant personality, we all know friends, pairs of friends, where one of them is a very dominant person and the second one is a very passive person. And in any encounter with them, you're always encountering the dominant personality, and the passive personality is just there. So that's very possibly the situation here. You have two personalities. One of them is a very dominant personality. The other one was just there. Matthew remembers, however, that he was there and records that in his account. Luke doesn't bother. Mark doesn't bother. Luke was not an eyewitness. He would have no reason to know necessarily that he was there. If the relevant person is not the human person but the demon, maybe you have passive demons and flamboyant demons as well. I don't know. I mean, but you may have the same situation there. It may be that Luke and Mark are simply telling the account of this demon, this one of the pair, who happened to spread the word throughout Decapolis, as we'll go on to see, that after this event was over, he became a very important conveyor of this information about Jesus that spread the word about Jesus throughout the whole of Decapolis. And maybe this is a story of how he came to be that missionary, if you will, in which case the other person is irrelevant because he didn't play the same role. So it's hard to know why Mark and Luke are not concerned with the second person, but they're not. But just because they're not concerned with it doesn't mean that there weren't two, just as Matthew said. The other question is, where does this event happen? There are a little geography lesson here. Galilee was to the north and to the west of the Sea of Galilee. The eastern shore, especially the northeast, was a part of the territory of one of the sons of Herod, Herod Philip, who was the tetrarch over a half a dozen smaller regions. And those smaller regions were clustered up to the north and east of the Sea of Galilee. To the south of Galilee, of course, was first Samaria and then Judea, and with the Samaritans in between, Galilee and Judea were the homes of the Jews. But to the east and to the southeast of the Sea of Galilee was a region called Decapolis. Decapolis, it comes from the Greek words deca, meaning ten, and polis, meaning cities. It was basically a military confederation or alliance between two virtually autonomous cities. They were semi-autonomous. These cities at the time in which this event takes place are under the Roman governor in Syria, I don't know where he was headquartered, maybe Damascus, but maybe not. But there was a Roman governor over the region of Syria that would have had overall Roman oversight over Decapolis. But for a long time, the ten cities of Decapolis had a great deal of autonomy and independence. They were founded, probably, for the most part, after Alexander the Great had conquered this region, and there had been Macedonian and Greek immigrants who came into the region and established these cities. So these were fairly significant cities with all of the richness of Greek culture, the Greek institutions, the Greek way of life built into the very foundations of these cities. And the Greeks, as you know, loved independence, loved their freedom. It was deep in their culture. And so for the most part, the governors, the Greek governors following Alexander, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids who fought over this area, tended to give them a certain amount of autonomy. Herod tended to give them a certain amount of autonomy. And then when Rome came along, Pompey liberated them and gave them a significant amount of autonomy. And that's the state that we find them in when this account takes place. There are a number of notable philosophers, rhetoricians, cultured people who come out of these cities. So this was a thriving part of Greek culture that was smack dab there in the middle of Palestine, bumping up against Galilee. In fact, part of Decapolis actually, an arm of Decapolis actually went over across to the western side of the Jordan River south of the Sea of Galilee and included a city called Scythopolis, which was on the southwest shore off the southwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. Well, it was really interesting because I had not realized how near at hand thoroughgoing, completely Greek culture was to Jesus and his disciples. They would not have been ignorant. They would have been rubbing shoulders with Greek culture during their lives. And Jesus takes a couple of trips into Decapolis. Undoubtedly, Jesus knew Greek then for that reason, because there was trade back and forth. The fishermen of the Sea of Galilee would take their fish over to the other side, and they would cure it and then ship it, export it to other places. So there had to be interaction between the Greeks and Greek culture and the Jews in Galilee. Well, someplace over in Decapolis is where they're headed on this journey. The problem is that you have some texts that speak of the Gadarenes, you have other texts that speak of the Gerasenes, and some texts speak of the Gergesenes. Well, why? All three of those are peoples at this time. Gergesa was a small, probably a little fishing village or maybe a little port on the center portion of the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Gadara was a large, major Greek city just to the southeast of the Sea of Galilee, about 6 miles from the lake itself. Gerasa, yeah, is about 30 miles from the lake to the southeast. Now, probably a lot of your English translations have the Gerasenes, as if these were the people from Gerasa. A lot of scholars think that's very unlikely, because we're talking 30 miles away, a significant distance from the lake. So when the people go to the city to report what has happened, you know, it's a 60-mile round-trip trek. That doesn't seem real likely. The only possibility, the only thing that would make that plausible would be, excuse me, if there was a portion of the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee that actually was under the control of Gerasa. And according to the geographers that I read, that's not implausible, that the cities not only had sort of an independent control over their city and some of the adjacent surrounding land, but oftentimes land that was not adjacent to them would be granted to them to be under their political control. And so if, for example, Gerasa wanted access to the Sea of Galilee to have some trade and commerce or something like that, it would not have been impossible for Pompey to have given them a portion of seashore, lakeshore, that would be under their control and therefore would be belong to the Gerasenes. So that's a possibility, and that may be why the gospel writers describe it as traveling to the land of the Gerasenes. What's more likely would be, if we're talking about a large city, would be Gadara, the Gadarenes, because they're only 6 miles away, and that's a little bit more plausible, and you have the same situation there, where the surrounding regions that they would have controlled would have undoubtedly reached to the lakeshore. When all is said and done, however, I'm inclined to think, because of what happens, that probably the texts that say the Gergesenes is the most accurate and original text, the little or smaller village that's in the middle of the lake on the east shore. Because if you've ever been to Israel, you know how imposing the cliffs are, the hills, how rapidly they rise from the lakeshore up to the Golan Heights. You know, the Golan Heights are just looming up above the Sea of Galilee. And we have this event of the swine on the hillside that go running down the steep banks into the sea and drown. The part of the lake where that event would seem most likely to have occurred would either have been on the southwest corner of the lake, where you have a similar steep cliffs going down into the sea, or on the eastern shore. So I don't really know, but I'm inclined to think that this was on the eastern shore near Gergesa. So what has happened is there's this man who comes from whatever the city is, whatever the town is. He's a citizen of that city, but he's become plagued by this demon. And we know not from this account, but from another gospel account, from the Matthew account, that as these two demon-plagued men hang out in the tombs, people were too afraid to even pass by there because they were so violent. So people feared them. They became violent and dangerous. So probably because this man was violent and dangerous, the townspeople tried to imprison him by putting him in chains and bonds. But he would break the chains and would just simply run into the desert. He would strip all the clothes off of himself and would live among the tombs naked and out of his mind. The people tried to protect him by keeping him in the city in chains, but he would just break the chains. So when this event comes to pass, he's in the tombs, naked, out of his mind. Jesus comes to the shore. The boats come to the shore, probably in the vicinity of these tombs. The man has spotted them, and he comes to encounter Jesus, probably in the same violent way that he comes to encounter anybody who passes by. Jesus commands, somehow recognizes that this is the result of demonic activity and commands the demon to leave him. The way Luke puts it is kind of strange, but the only way I can make sense of it, and I think most of the other translations do the same thing, is that it gives you this conversation back and forth between Jesus and the demon, and then it explains that the encounter was due to the fact that Jesus already had commanded the unclean spirit to depart from the man. So the demon recognizes Jesus, probably after Jesus has commanded the unclean spirit to leave. The demon recognizes the identity of who Jesus is. He shrieks and falls down before him, and in a loud voice said, "What is your concern with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." Now, Matthew adds, I think, an important piece of information. He says, "Have you come to torment me before the time?" And I think the "before the time" could be significant. I'll talk about that in a second. But he says, "What's your concern with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Notice how good his theology is here. He knows exactly who Jesus is. He knows exactly what kind of authority he has. "I beg you, do not torment me." So Jesus at this point asks, "What is your name?" Now, why did he do that? Well, most religious studies people have a field day with stuff like this. Well, you see, the ancients, poor, benighted, ignorant souls that they were, they believed that if you knew the name of someone, then you had power and authority over them, and having power and authority, that gave you power and authority over them. So Jesus believed that he needed to get his name in order to have authority over him, and so on. Well, the problem with that is that this is the only place, I forgot to check this out, but I believe this is the only place where Jesus ever gets the name of a demon before he orders it to leave. So I don't think Jesus is worried about that. He's quite capable of ordering any unclean spirit at any time to leave, and it must leave. He doesn't need to know its name. So why is he asking for the name of this particular demon? The only sense I can make of this is that I think Jesus knows somehow that this is a bad case of demonitis, whatever. You know, this is a really acute case. There are more than one demon here. And in order to reveal that fact to the people who are witnessing this, in order that they might know that, in order that it can become explicit to them, how significant this matter is, he wants it to be known that there are many demons and not just one demon here. I don't know why the name Legion. I don't know if they're being cute. I don't know if, I don't know. I mean, it's obviously a military term to talk about, to speak of them as if they were a Roman legion, a military unit of the army. Don't know why, but they identify themselves as this legion. We're this legion of unclean spirits, and they give that as the name. And they kept imploring Jesus not to command them to go away into the abyss. Okay, what's the abyss? The abyss is just a word that's used to describe any kind of unfathomably deep place, essentially. And it's oftentimes the Hebrew word that corresponds to this is often just translated the deep. It's in Genesis 1:2 and this, what? Something was on the deep, was over the deep. The spirit hover over the deep. What did he do? That's translated by this word abyss in the Greek Septuagint. But there's a particular form in which we see this word used that I think is significant here. That is in Revelation 20, if you'll remember, Satan is thrown into the abyss and is locked in the abyss, imprisoned in the abyss for 1,000 years so that he might not deceive the nation. nations. And then at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan is released once again in order to go out and deceive the nations. And I've told you my particular interpretation of that, that it seems to me that with the coming of Jesus and the apostles, we see the beginning of that 1,000-year period where Satan is locked in the abyss for 1,000 years and will one day be released again to go out and deceive the nations. And I believe we are currently within that 1,000-year period where the activity of Satan and his unclean spirits is relatively curtailed relative to how it had been before the 1,000 years began. And I think that's the period that we're talking about. If that's the case, then one way of understanding the role of Jesus at this time was to come into the world and drive the demons into the abyss. I mean, that was one of his responsibilities. That was one of his functions. If that's true, that explains quite well this encounter. Jesus, why have you come to torment us before the time? That is a ploy to say, wait, we got a couple more weeks before this is supposed to happen. You're premature here. We don't have to go into the abyss yet. And then when they see that Jesus is intent on commanding them, they implore him, but don't send us into the abyss. Don't send us into the abyss. So, as it turns out, they have this great idea. They see this field of swine. Now, interesting, this is not Jewish territory. That's why you can have a herd of swine. You would never have a herd of swine in Jewish territory because they were an unclean animal. They were of no use to the Jews. So they just wouldn't have kept swine. But because this is Greek territory and Greek culture, we have a herd of swine on the hillside. They see this herd of swine and ask permission from Jesus to go among them. Okay, Jesus grants them permission. What, compassion? What is this? I mean, if I were Jesus, I would have said, no. You're going straight to the abyss, not passing go, not collecting $200. You're going straight to the abyss. What's with this? Again, I have to think that what Jesus is doing here is for the sake of the people that are witnesses to this. He wants them to see. He wants them to see in graphic terms what sort of authority has been granted to him. By sending them into the swine, it becomes a graphic illustration of how many, I think, of how many demons there are that he's commanding here. Because the whole herd of swine goes berserk. And there may very well have been hundreds of swine. And the whole herd of them goes berserk. And they go in their berserkness, they go running down the hill and into the sea and drown. Now, I'm inclined to think that this was not compassion. This was not a reprieve. The swine drown and the demons go to the abyss. I'm inclined to think that that is ultimately where they end up. But they go to the abyss by way of the swine, whatever that is, whatever that looks like. They go to the abyss by way of the swine in order that the drowning of this whole herd of the swine makes it clear to everyone who witnessed this, Jesus just commanded a whole legion of unclean spirits, and they had to obey. And so the scope and extent of his authority would just sort of graphically played out before everyone who could see it. The story is very simply, it's just a question of the people of that area hearing the herdsmen saw what happened. They went and told the people in the city, the people come out, they see this man that they knew to be a notoriously violent, demon-plagued person sitting clothed and in his right mind. They heard the account of what happened, and how do they respond? They're frightened. Now, you know, before we blame them too much, I mean, wouldn't you be frightened as well? I mean, anytime anybody has that kind of authority and that kind of power, it is so different. It is so alien to our experience to see a human being with that kind of authority that you can't help but be freaked by it. Wow, what does that mean? It's not someone that you automatically bow to, serve, worship, adore, honor, respect, and whatever. You say, you're kind of wrecking my life. Would you leave? I don't know what to do with you. You make me uncomfortable. Would you leave? And I think that's what we have here is if you have that kind of power and that kind of authority, west side of the lake, that's far enough away from me, but would you please go there? A lot of Bible teachers try to emphasize the economic loss of the swine, that they were ticked for their economic loss. What's interesting is not a single one of the gospel writers mentioned that explicitly. And I'm sure that it registered. I'm sure that it annoyed them. I mean, I'm sure that's true. But I don't think that's the big deal here. I don't think they're mad at him because he ripped them off. I think they're scared of him because he has the kind of authority that he has, and they just want him to leave. So he decides to leave. That in and of itself is interesting. I mean, in all likelihood, Jesus didn't come to this side of the lake only to go right back again. That was God's doing, not his doing. He probably had one set of plans about what he was going to do in Decapolis, but first thing out of the boat, he's confronted with this legion of demons around a man and confronts them, commands them into the abyss, and then gets everybody so freaked that they say, depart from us, we don't want you here. So he does. God is in control of his agenda, not Jesus. So he's going to return to the other side of the lake. The man from whom Legion had been driven away says, I want to go with you. We see this consistently throughout the gospel accounts, the love and affection and loyalty that many of the people who had demons driven away from them feel toward Jesus. Remember, we just confronted that earlier in the chapter, these women, every one of these women who were so loyal, such loyal followers of Jesus, had diseases due to demons, had been healed of their diseases that were due to demons. So this man, too, has this incredible sense of loyalty. He just wants to be with Jesus. He just wants to follow him in this incredible gratitude and love that makes him want to go with him. But Jesus says, no, go to your house and describe what great things God has done for you. And the man does so obediently and proclaims throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. In the Mark account, it says his account spread throughout the whole of Decapolis. So this one event in Jesus' life ends up being an event that declares the authority and magnificence of Jesus throughout the whole of this Greek culture perched on the east of Judea. Okay, let me make a couple of closing observations and then I'll open it up to your questions. Are demons active today? I don't know. If you were to go by my experience, I would say no. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I've been to two exorcisms in my life, and in both cases, I wasn't convinced that there was a demon within 5 miles of the place. I mean, just nothing about the encounter struck me as authentic. On the other hand, I took the occasion just this past week. I mean, oftentimes what we hear is that missionaries from some of the third world countries, that this is much more commonplace for them to actually encounter demons. So I took the occasion. We had as a graduation speaker a man from Zambia, Africa, a man that I very much trust, an intelligent man with a great deal of discernment that I just trust him. So as I was driving to the airport, I said, I'm teaching tomorrow. I've got a question for you. You ever seen a demon? And he told me this story about a woman who came to his church, and he was not inclined. He was more or less skeptical about demons. This is a very commonsensical man who's not gullible. And he was very skeptical about demons, but he had this encounter. I won't give you the details, but he had this encounter with this woman that he utterly convinced him that what she had been plagued by a demon due to witchcraft in her family's past, and that it, in praying with her, the demon left and totally changed her life. So I have to take that seriously. I mean, it's one thing to hear that report from anonymous sources, people that you don't know what their agenda is, you don't know what their worldview is, you don't know how susceptible they are to believing such a thing, you don't know how gullible they are. That doesn't do much for me, because I just know all the different kinds of things that people believe for who knows what kinds of reasons. But I trust this man, and for him to tell me that he's confronted what he is convinced is a demon weighs heavily with me. There's nothing about my theology that has a problem with that. It's clear from the New Testament that even though, as I would understand it, Satan has been imprisoned in the abyss, that doesn't stop Peter, is it, from saying, be on guard against Satan who's prowling like a lion, whatever. You know it. That Satan, whatever the picture of Satan being imprisoned in the abyss, is not a picture of Satan being gone from the world, having no effect in the world, being absent from the world, but simply his activity being so greatly curtailed that it is not darkness that controls our lives, but it's the light. Why is it that we can believe? Why is it that we can see? Why is it that we can understand the truth? Because the darkness has not nullified the light. But there was a time when the whole world was in darkness, and the whole world was pagan. The whole world believed in other gods other than the one true God. If I'm reading my prophecy right, the world will return to that one day. The darkness will descend once again, and there will only be pockets of light left. But not yet. In the meantime, the gospel can still go forth, and we can still get it, we can still understand it, and we can still see. But can there be pockets of darkness, individual experiences and individuals where unclean spirits and Satan and demonic activity can still deceive and can entrap and ensnare? Apparently so, if Moffat's story is an indication. Does the ordinary believer have authority over demons? I think oftentimes in Christian culture we get that sense that, well, in Jesus' name, I'm more powerful than any demon. Well, there's nothing in the Bible that actually indicates that. It's true that Jesus delegates authority to the 12 and grants them authority over demons, and later to the 70 that he sends out and grants them authority over demons. But Jesus delegated that authority and gave them that authority over demons. But does Jack have authority over demons? I don't have any reason to think so. I could command anybody in anybody's name. I mean, even in Jesus' name. Yes, Jesus has authority over demons, but it doesn't mean I have authority to command them. So I think it's a fallacy, when we in Christian culture give the impression that in Jesus I am more powerful than demons and I can command them and order them to leave. I don't think that's true. Only if God wants, only if God wills, will a demon be commanded. How do demons affect us? Boy, that's the mystery of mysteries to me. You know, this spiritual, non-material, incorporeal entity. What kind of access to a human being can a demon have and get? One thing that's interesting is the superhuman strength of this man who has legion hanging around. I don't even know what language to use. Who has legion hanging around him? We do know that certain drugs can affect a part of our brain. And when they affect a certain part of our brain, it nullifies that mechanism in us that says, don't exert too much strength or you're going to break your own bones. You know, that we have a mechanism that keeps us from being too strong for our own good. It's not that my muscles are not strong enough to be that strong, but my body can't take me being that strong. So there's built in physiologically a mechanism that prevents me from being stronger than my own good. But there are certain drugs that nullify that, and police officers can tell you the superhuman strength of those people on those drugs. It can take 4 and 5 and 6 officers to control them because they're stronger than they ought to be. Can demons somehow affect parts of our brain such that it can have the same effect on us and give us supernatural strength? Perhaps so. I don't know, but I'm no more mystified by that than I am mystified by the relationship between the spirit of who I am and the organ of the brain that I have. We know that there's some kind of connection. We know that there's some kind of interplay between the real spiritual me that exists and the organic me of my brain. But no one knows the answer to that. Philosophy of mind, I took a whole class on philosophy of mind as a graduate student, is the most mysterious subject in all of philosophy, it seems to me. It's virtually unanswerable. But that's what we're dealing with, is whatever the relationship between demons and human beings, it somehow is wrapped in the same mystery as the relationship between my own mind and my brain. Okay. Almost out of time, but we have a few minutes for your comments or questions.
Let's see here. Oh, yeah. I don't know if this is an appropriate question or if it seems sacrilegious. I don't mean for it to. but you were talking about how we should want our lives to be what God wants it to be and should sort of submit to the script. But if we recognize that God scripts everything that we do, then it's not really possible, and or any rebellion that we accomplish will be God-given, right?
That's true, yeah.
Does that present any sort of problem for most people? It seems that, like, well, I'm rebelling, and God wants me to rebel, or like that's part of the script, that's what I'm meant to do, and go, I don't know.
That's true. Ultimately, God is going to, is also scripting how I'm responding and what I'm doing in my freedom. That's true, but I still experience my freedom as freedom. Nobody else is making me decide whether I'm going to submit to the will of God or resist the will of God. That's something that I can resolve within the depths of my own will. And that's what we're called upon to do in faith, is to resolve it in the direction of saying, not my will, but your will be done. And to the extent that we experience ourselves as free, then that's what we should freely do. That's all. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely. In the end, why would I freely submit to God rather than resist him? Well, God, the author of my being, is making me into a rebel rather than a believer.
I had one other quick question.
Okay.
How could Jesus sleep through the storm?
He was God. Hey, come on. Yeah, good question. I don't know. Must have not had a guilty conscience. That's a good question.
Guess I should say I've slept through storms.
Okay.
Anyway, I've heard you say earlier in Luke, a long time ago, talking about Satan dealing with Jesus, and I think I heard you saying that Satan didn't really know what was going to happen. It's just his purpose was to thwart the Son of God. He knew that
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm.
And it just confuses me a little with this demon, or these demons seem to know something, you know, that they're going to go to the abyss. That's not the time yet or something. Is that related at all?
Good question. I'm trying to remember the context. What I was saying that Satan didn't know was the ultimate result of the crucifixion, that he was, right?
I think when you're even, well, it was, I think it was when you were talking about the temptations of Jesus, but also in light of the movie, The Passion of the Christ,
mm-hmm.
and how that, in that movie, it seemed like Satan knew he was trying to
thwart. Right.
Jesus.
Well, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, just because they may not know the significance of the cross doesn't necessarily mean that they don't know what Jesus' role in relationship to them is, that his role is to imprison them in the abyss. They may very well know that. And if they didn't know that a priori, remember, he's been casting out demons for some time now. And I don't know how demons communicate across lakes, but it could be that they have come through experience to realize there's this one come among us who has the authority to command us, and what he's commanding us to do is to depart to the abyss. So maybe they've just learned that through experience. I don't know.
I'm wondering, when Jesus rebukes the disciples and says, "Where's your faith?" If maybe that instead of scolding them, he's rhetorically, soberly challenging them, saying, "Where's your allegiance? Here's food for thought." And whether the Matthew account, where he does it before calming the storm or after, still he's putting that out there. He's declaring his authority. I mean, afterwards, of course, it's more powerful. Where's your faith now, big boy? You know, look at what just happened. But I mean, I could see him putting it out there saying, "Where's your heart? Where's your allegiance?" And then this great display of power, certainly the resulting in the fear, which is perhaps the beginning of wisdom in this case, is a statement for them to think about.
So are you basically questioning my describing it as rebuke or a scold?
Well, I mean, it occurred to me as you were saying, I never thought of it this way before. I always thought of it as a rebuke, as a scold. But perhaps he was saying, "Okay, ye of little faith," or "Where is your faith? Why are you afraid?" In more of a rhetorical sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then knowing full well where their faith was or wasn't.
Yeah. I think that's very possible. It's this kind of thing where it's really difficult in writing, because so much of that, it's our nonverbal part of our communication that communicates impatience or annoyance or, you know, whatever. And we have no way of knowing what. I suspect that he's not annoyed, that he's not, so it's not scolding and rebuke in the way that we would scold and rebuke out of impatience, but out of compassion, out of a desire to get them thinking along the right lines, and out of a desire to make a point with them. So in that sense, yeah, to call it a rebuke or a scold could be misleading, because I don't really mean to imply, I wouldn't have any reason to think that he's annoyed or impatient with them. So yeah, maybe the way you characterized it would be better.
I mean, I could see it going too far if it could come across as arrogance in a sense. A great display of power. It's like, okay, whose side are you on now? But yeah, I don't think he means it that way.
No.
I'm just kind of, I guess, qualifying what you were saying. Right?
Yeah. Okay. No, that's good. That's helpful. And we do need to be careful that we don't read ourselves into Jesus, because we, you know, that our attitudes and the way we would respond and what we would mean by these same kinds of words are often just saturated with our own sinfulness and short-sightedness and impatience and annoyance and stuff like that. And there's no reason to think that that was true of Jesus.
Don't bother me.
Don't bother me.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
A thought occurred to me, it's the same spot, is that when he says, "Where's your faith?" I keep thinking about Abraham and Isaac, and the fact that Jesus, I can't remember all that comes before this, but I mean, the fact is that Jesus was the Messiah, and it just occurred to me, I was wondering if maybe that "Where's your faith?" is, "Don't you know who I am? I mean, God's not going to drown me here." Hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that they wouldn't get drowned. I mean, so they could have fear for that. But, I mean, he's in the boat with them. And, I mean, and their next question is, who is this that can command all these things? That maybe, I mean, it was kind of a demonstration of, I mean, the whole thing to demonstrate to them who he really was and what being the Messiah meant and everything. But, I mean, there's no way to tie it. I mean, there's not enough information here to know exactly, you know, what, like you said, what he meant by "What is your faith?" But it just occurred to me that thing, that it would could be linked to who he was and their understanding of who he was and what part he had to play in what was going to happen. I mean,
yeah, that could
kind
be.
Of to That's end God's story prematurely, he said, well, of course not, because mm-hmm. something else is going to happen. And then just a little quick question. It's always, I don't know, it's just always bothered me a little bit when he tells the man to go away and tell everything that God has done for him, and he goes away and tells, I mean, just the whole next sentence is, he goes away and says everything that Jesus did for him. I'm sure the two are linked, but it's just always...
Well, there is a certain amount of lack of understanding in someone who is healed by Jesus, who talks about what Jesus did for him rather than what God did for him. Now, not that you want to downplay the importance of Jesus, but the problem is, if all you talk about is what Jesus did for someone, that can easily be misunderstood, that Jesus is simply an X-man rather than the Son of God. And so to that extent, I think there is a significant difference there.
Yeah. And Jesus was saying, I mean, he didn't say, go and say what I did for you.
Right.
I mean, that's important.
Yeah. Okay, one more, Roger, and then...
It just gives this inference from what you're saying that Jesus could not have been a physically impressive person, because most of us, to a fault, will look at someone who's attractive and physically attractive to have more credence than someone who is not as well shaped, let's put it that way, mm-hmm. or or unattractive.
Mm-hmm. And what part of it are you...
In his believability, in his faith in him, here's a person who is very common or ordinary and not attractive, whereas most of course, maybe we've been brainwashed through television and media, that, you know, somebody who is an attractive person is more intelligent or demands greater respect because of their physical presence.
Mm-hmm. Or their charisma.
Charisma,
yeah.
Exactly. And it appears to me that he is extremely plain... that he doesn't demand this charisma.
Uh-huh.
This is because otherwise they would have, and their understanding, in other words, they're having to go on faith and understanding as opposed to physical qualities right. that would naturally attract someone to that demands respect just from that.
Huh. Good point.
And that's what comes across to me, because Jesus, so obvious when we read it. How could you be such a ignoramus?
Yeah.
Well, he must have been. I mean, how tall were those people at that time?
Good question. I don't know.
And their size and their... And no one actually has a picture of him or his facial characteristics. But that's what comes across to me, because I just can't see why they wouldn't have this confidence in him.
Mm-hmm.
Like confidence or faith or trust. They weren't to that level, and he was surprised. That's what it comes across to me.
Yeah. Good point.
Okay.
Thanks. I need to let you go. I've kept you over. Thank you.